Okay, we're going to continue with the confession of faith. We're up to chapter 22 of Lawful Oaths and Vows, and section 3. Section 3 of chapter 22 of Lawful Oaths and Vows. Whosoever taketh an oath ought duly to consider the weightiness of so solemn an act, and therein to avouch nothing. What he is fully persuaded is the truth. Neither may any man bind himself by oath to anything but what is good and just, and what he believeth so to be, and what he is able and resolving to perform. Yet it is a sin to refuse an oath touching anything that is good and just, being imposed by lawful authority. Last time, we talked about the fact that oaths and vows are parts of religious worship, that they are entered into in the name of God. And we also talked a little bit about this idea of lawful authority, which comes up again here. This idea of lawful authority, in fact, is extremely prevalent throughout all of these discussions. And it's prevalent for good reason. It's not enough that there be a so-called authority imposing an oath. It needs to be a lawful authority, because the very nature of an oath or vow is that it is religious worship. So remember, the Westminster Divines are writing in the context of a nation that is covenanted with God, a nation wherein they've already pledged, much like Israel was bound, not to have anyone who was not their brother set over them. And all lawful authority in terms of the Solemn League would be, in fact, authority that was conformed to the Reformed faith. That's just a little bit of context there. It is impossible for a Christian to take an oath or a vow from someone who is not also professing the true religion, if they're imposing it, because they are going to be imposing it as a matter of their worship, and their worship and the God that they worship is entirely different. Yes, light of nature tells them that they ought to do this, but light of nature, although it tells them there is a God, does not tell them who that God is. So those are two very different things. Now, there's several things we have to consider in this section. The first thing is the weightiness of taking an oath. And that weightiness, to really understand the gravity of the situation in which an oath is involved, then we're going to understand that we have to avouch nothing in an oath but what we're fully persuaded is true. Okay, so people, and this is precisely why, for example, in the court system, people are judged doubly guilty if they swear to tell the truth, and then they turn around and they avouch something that's not the truth. Right? They're even reminded in our court system that they are only to avouch the truth. I'm not saying that their lawful authority is imposing this, mind you. But they are entering into a vow to do this when people do this. And while we are always under an obligation to tell the truth, when we have taken an oath or a vow to that truth and we fail, we add to our guilt the crime of perjury. Because when we take an oath or a vow, there is a voluntary assumption of that duty. And we're recognizing that. So we need to be very, very clear in ourselves that something is true. It's not going to be enough to be dependent upon, for example, the testimony of someone else as to the truth of something. You need to know that it's true. Now, this has bearing in the Reformed Presbyterian Church with respect to the six terms of communion. We're not asking you to tender an implicit faith. You know, believe it because I say it's true. Believe it because the church says it's true. No, we're asking you to affirm these things because you understand them yourself to be true. You've taken time, you've been catechized, you've had opportunity to examine these things and to think about whether or not these things are true. And if you can't take those terms of communion in truth, then you shouldn't do it. Because you are, in fact, going to be held responsible. You know, ultimately, the enforcer of an oath or vow, as we've seen, is God. You're calling him to witness, and you're calling him to be an avenger and judge in case there's a breach. Furthermore, we need to look at this second point that they bring up, and that is that you can't take an oath or a vow, particularly in this case we're talking about oaths, but you can't take an oath to do anything except what's good and just. In other words, you don't have the right, and no one has the right, to impose upon you an oath that would demand that you sin, or even do something questionable. It has to be good, it has to be just, and you need to believe it so. But furthermore, there are a couple of other elements here. And that is, you have to be able to do it. So you can't enter into an oath or vow unless you are able to do it and are, furthermore, resolved to do it. Now, when we look at the doctrine of covenanting, which is intimately related to what we're talking about, the same thing applies. You know, nations are not to enter into covenants that they are not able to perform or resolve to perform. But, having once entered into the vow, anything you do that makes you either unable or unresolved to perform that vow, that's further sin on your part. So when Scotland entered into a national covenant, they had the ability to perform it. They may not have the ability today, but that's their sin. It's a result of their sin. And if they were more resolved, they would find again the ability to do it. Same with the Solemn League. The nations that entered into that, the nations that were contemplated in that, they may no longer have the ability, at least immediately, to perform it. The fact is, they don't have the resolve to perform it either. That's not an excuse. It's not even an extenuation. It's actually an aggravation. And the same goes for any oath or vow that you personally enter into. If you take an oath or a vow, a lawful oath or vow imposed by lawful authority, And at some point, you, in some way, or for some reason, cause yourself to be unable or put aside the resolve to perform it, it's not an extenuation, it's an aggravation. And we're going to see this when we discuss the doctrine of marriage and divorce, for example. You know, one of the things you do when you get married is you take a vow. And in doing so, you are able. You've already been judged able by those around you, and you have confessed yourself able by undertaking that. And you must do so then with the resolve to perform the terms of that vow. If you do not, or if you do anything that makes or creates an inability, some sort of obstacle, the fault lies with you. That oath or that vow is going to stand as a testament, and God will judge in the breach of that oath or vow. So it's important then that not only do you make sure that the matter of an oath or vow is good and just, but you shouldn't be taking an oath or vow to do something you can't do. You shouldn't take an oath or a vow to push a boulder up a hill if you can't do it. You shouldn't take an oath or a vow to fly an airplane if you can't do it. Right? You shouldn't be entering into something with the hope that maybe someday you'll be able to do it. And it's important to understand, again, that the Westminster Divines who took the Solemn League and the Scottish Reformers that took that national covenant, they didn't do so with this idea that maybe sometime in the future they would be able to perform it. They understood themselves to be possessed of the ability to do it, and they had the resolve to do it when they took it. And that should be the same attitude we all have when we are, in fact, faced with an oath or a vow. Once we've ascertained it's good, it's just, but you don't have a right to enter into an oath or a vow that is not good or unjust. And in fact, this is why it's very dangerous for people to undertake an oath or a vow on their own, rather than waiting upon lawful authority to impose it. It's not to say that it's never appropriate, but if you understand how serious a matter it is, then you would understand why you should be very, very careful not to enter into an oath or vow rashly. And we talked about that a little bit last time, but it was a practice of Matthew Henry every year. On January 1st of every year, he would write out a covenant. He would take an oath to renewed obedience to God. And some of these, we still have copies of some of these that have come down to us. The Puritans were very famous for doing this sort of thing. But they didn't do it every day, and they certainly did so weighing the gravity of the situation.
Is that also done maybe on some grievous fall into sin, where as one of the means to recovery is just to repent and to renew that covenant?
It can be.
Especially, like, it all goes back to your baptismal vows, right? If you've been baptized.
There are vows in baptism. There are vows, you know, that you make with terms of communion. there are vows that you may renew, or in some cases you might simply take a vow because of some situation. It may be a just and lawful thing to do, but you need to remember that it is a great matter. It's not something to be done flippantly. You know, when and this is actually quite common in wartime, that men will cry out to God from the foxhole and swear to God that they'll do this or that. And very often they come back from war and they forget what they've done. Now, it was very different with a man named Luther. Luther actually did so at one time in the midst of a great storm. He was frightened. And that's how he ended up becoming a monk. He was quick to perform that vow. The problem is we'll see later on in this chapter, monkish vows are inherently unlawful. However, just the fact that he kept that vow, at least until he came to understand its unlawfulness, that showed a certain amount of fidelity on his part. You know, and until he was converted, that was really a demonstration of his seriousness about matters of religion. You know, he wasn't yet converted, but in the end, this is going to be something that is conducive to his conversion and is something that really prepares him for the ministry he's going to have. Right? So it's not to say that God can't bring something good out of an unlawful vow kept. You know, you can enter into an unlawful vow, but there's this very difficult situation that you're now in that you have to keep that vow even though it's unlawful, as long as you still believe it's lawful. Otherwise, you're going to be sinning against conscience. And that creates another problem for you. So it's important that you're clear on all of these matters, that you are careful when it comes to entering into oaths and vows. And again, the last thing that we'll talk about is it's sinful to refuse an oath if it's something good and just when it's being imposed by lawful authority. And so again, you don't, even a lawful authority does not have the right to impose an oath or a vow to do something sinful. You know, there are people like your parents you must obey in all things, unless they command you to do something clearly sinful. If they command that, you can't render obedience to that. You don't have a right. At that point, as the apostles say, you know, we ought to obey God rather than men. So these are the three points that are taken up in this section. We're going to discuss them in turn, and we'll have to look at some applications as well along the way. So question one then. Ought whosoever takes an oath duly to consider the weightiness of so solemn an act, and therein to avouch nothing but what he is fully persuaded is the truth? The answer is yes. Look at Exodus 20, verse 7.
Exodus 20, verse 7. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain.
And we need to remember again, this doctrine of oaths and vows is actually immediately of concern in one of the Ten Commandments. But that should tell us how important this is. You know, God could have mentioned a lot of things, but when he gave us his top Ten Commandments, when he tells us, you know, the don'ts, really, for the most part, the don'ts in life, he says, don't take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. That is to say, don't enter into an unlawful oath or vow. Now, we take that, a lot of times, we've taken the name of the Lord in vain, we understand to any profanation of the name of God, and that's right, because any invocation of the name of God, or of his attributes, or his supreme deity, any kind of flippant reference to that is a violation of this commandment. So every time you see somebody putting, you know, oh my God, OMG, they're violating this command. You know, we've become a very profane society. There's a difference between taking the name of the Lord in vain and Billingsgate, which is just common vulgarity. Right? The commandment is forbidding, in particular, the taking of the Lord's name in vain. And that is something which he warns is severely punished. Now, if it's such a serious matter that it even extends to these flippant mentions of God or his attributes, whether we talk about his holiness or his goodness, oh my goodness, you know, those kinds of things are all skirting this issue, getting very close to the edge of directly blaspheming God. You should stay away from them. You know, there's no reason to go near the edge of the cesspool lest you fall in. If those things are so important and so really such magnitude, how much more than when we're actually going to take an oath, reflectively taking an oath, you know, just sitting down and entering into a vow. Right, an oath being a solemn appeal to God invoked as witness that some statement made is true, the oath taker ought to consider the weightiness of the act. Deuteronomy 5:11 and 6:13.
Deuteronomy 5:11. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless that taketh his name in vain.
Deuteronomy 6:13. Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name.
The very fact that we're told that in this appeal we're to make it with respect to God, that is a very good indication already that we're talking about something that is or should be approached very seriously. And if we understand that the glory of God is bound up with his name, that is the great weightiness of everything that is. I mean, God is the supreme being, the most substantial substance. He is, in fact, what is really real. So if we're going to invoke him as witness, knowing, as we've talked about before, that he's everywhere present, right? He's omnipresent, he's omniscient. Nothing is hidden from him. And so we're calling him to be a witness that something is true. We certainly don't want to be swearing that everything in the Encyclopedia Britannica is true. We really don't want to be swearing that everything on the internet is true. But whatever it is, it's before us, that we do want to make sure is true. We're going to invoke God to be witness that this thing is true. We need to know that it's true and be persuaded that it's true. We have to be sure that there's nothing less than true in what we're doing. Right, so when used, not in giving evidence before men, but in religious exercises strictly personal, the oath is never sworn but to confirm truth. When you're not going to enter into an oath or take an oath except to confirm that something is true. We saw this before. Paul does this a lot. As God is my witness, I call God to witness. That's an oath. He's saying that what I'm saying is true, and I call God to bear record that what I'm saying is true. To in fact make clear that what I'm saying is true. Thus the oath prescribed for Israel on returning to the Lord was explicitly an owning of that which was true. Look at Jeremiah 4, 1 and 2.
Jeremiah 4, verses 1 and 2. If thou wilt return, O Israel, saith the Lord, return unto me, and if thou wilt put away thine abominations out of my sight, then shalt thou not remove. And thou shalt swear, the Lord liveth in truth, in judgment, and in righteousness, and the nations shall bless themselves in him, and in him shall they glory.
So when they return to the Lord, you know, they're not returning on the pretext of a lie. When we are taking an oath that is religious, in a religious exercise, we are not going to be affirming a lie or confirming a lie. We want to make sure that what we are affirming or confirming is true. It needs to be without, as we'll see next time, there can't be any mental reservations. You can't have any other kinds of evasive intentions or evasive thoughts. In all of that, you can't mentally cross your fingers as if this oath or vow is not really true. Right? You need to understand that what you're doing is going to be definitive in this way. You are in fact evoking the just judgment of God to stand between you and what you're saying, and you know, if you fail in this, that is to say, if you are not owning what is true, there's going to be a consequence. We've talked about that before as well. Right, so it's very, very serious, very weighty thing, and therefore they're confuted. They do error who maintain it's a small thing or nothing to swear by the Lord God and call upon him for confirmation of some slight matter or matter of falsehood. A lot of people just don't think it's a big deal. You know, a lot of people, I don't know if they do it so much now, but I can remember people very often saying, you know, swear to God. That's exactly contrary to what we're talking about here. Okay, you need to be clear. You're clearly persuaded. It's true. And it shouldn't be a slight matter, and it certainly shouldn't be a false matter. Right, we're not to be engaged in that. So they're confuted for the following reasons. One, God swears, or God commands, excuse me, that men swear in truth because of who he is. Look at Leviticus 19:12.
Leviticus 19:12, and you shall not swear by my name falsely, neither shalt thou profane the name of thy God. I am the Lord.
And he says, I am the Lord. He's saying we need to swear in truth because he himself is the embodiment of all that is good and just and true.
So if you do one of these, you know, I swear to God about X, Y, or Z, and you know it's like wrong, you're lying, you're sort of doubly adding to your...
Yeah, it's not just a lie at that point. It is a lie. That's bad enough. That's bearing false witness. Okay? But when you've added to this an oath, you've actually taken the Lord's name in vain.
It's more a high-handed attack.
It's a much more high-handed, full frontal attack on the glory and dignity of God.
So you're not walking softly like Ahaz.
No, you're coming right at him. You're right. It's high-handed, and in fact, you are directly calling upon God by invoking his name to be judge in this matter.
Just ask him to be whacked.
You're asking to receive not only your just reward, but to get it swiftly. Okay, so we need to be very, very, very careful in this matter. You know, if you're quick to swear, or you're not at all concerned to enter into an oath, take an oath to confirm something that you know is false, it's probably a pretty good indication you're not a believer. You should not be fast and loose with the truth to begin with, but secondly, you certainly should not take any kind of oath or vow to try to support that. I mean, really, most of the time what you're doing in that case is you're trying to deceive someone, or maybe even deceive yourself with regard to the thing in consideration. All right, second, those who do swear falsely are consumed and under the wrath of God. Jeremiah 5:2-4.
Jeremiah 5:2-4. And though they say the Lord liveth, surely they swear falsely. O Lord, are not thine eyes upon the truth? Thou hast stricken them, but they have not grieved. Thou hast consumed them, but they have refused to receive correction. They have made their faces harder than a rock. They have refused to return. Therefore I said, surely these are poor. They are foolish, for they know not the way of the Lord, nor the judgment of their God.
Yeah, there is a certain hardness in this, swearing falsely. They're consumed, that is, it is like a spiritual cancer, just eating you alive. That's bad enough. But, you know, you're in that situation because you're under the wrath of God. So it's a very, very serious thing. You know, swearing falsely is extremely serious. If you do it, there will be consequences. Right, third, there's a calling down of the wrath of God upon oneself when swearing to that which is slight or false. Look at 1 Kings 8, 31 and 32.
1 Kings 8, 31 and 32. When a man shall trespass against his neighbor, and he lay upon him an oath to cause him to swear, and the swearer shall come before thine altar into thy house. Then hear thou in heaven, and do and judge thy servants, that thou condemn the wicked to bring his way upon his head, and justify the righteous to give him according to his righteousness.
So there's a recognition in that in entering into an oath or a vow, that you're not only calling upon God to witness, but specifically, you're calling down the wrath of God upon anyone who is entering into an oath or a vow either falsely or over some slight matter. Again, this is why we should be very, very careful that we don't invoke the name of God in a profane manner, or invoke the attributes of God in a profane manner, you know, over some slight thing. This is all swearing that is so very contrary to what we are commanded to do here. We are, in fact, entering into a situation where we're calling down the wrath of God. When you use the name of God in an oath or a vow respecting some slight matter or some falsehood, and you might as well be asking God simply to strike you dead and cast you into hell. And you're calling down his wrath, whether you recognize it or not. And I want to reiterate that that's precisely why you need to watch. You know, a lot of people think of oaths and vows simply as, you know, I state your name, do solemnly swear, blank, and so on. No. A rash oath or a rash vow is any invocation of the name or the attributes of God. And as I mentioned last time, that's intimately tied up with the unlawful use of a lot, because a lot is an invocation of the name of God. That's why our catechism covers this under the third commandment. Right? When we cast dice or cut the deck of cards, when we do anything, engage in anything where the lot is being invoked, we're invoking the name of God. So there is, in fact, a violation here. And it's very much like unto what we're talking about in this chapter. It's a violation of the third commandment, precisely because there is an implicit oath or vow involved in the casting of the die, the cutting of the cards, the spinning of the wheel, you know, whatever you're casting. And so we need to be very, very careful then how we approach this, because we are calling down the wrath of God on ourselves. Am I doing that? People that teach kids to play at these games are teaching children to engage in activity that calls down the wrath of God. You need to be very careful about what you're teaching your children. Consider what some of these things really entail. We know that these things are all invoking the name of God, because God is automatically being invoked when you flip a coin or toss a die. And nothing happens in this universe by chance. There are no accidents. There are only appointments. And when we throw some minor thing into it and ask God to make a decision, because ultimately that's what we're doing, then we're invoking His name. There is an oath aspect involved here. Right, four. At the very hearing of such profaneness, when concealed by the hearer, is grounds for condemnation before God. Look at Leviticus 5:1.
Leviticus 5:1. And if a soul sin and hear the voice of swearing and is a witness, whether he hath seen or known of it, if he do not utter it, then he shall bear his iniquity.
Yeah, the fact is, it's not... This is how serious it is. If you hear someone take a rash oath or vow, and you don't call them out on it, you are guilty as well. You are going to be held accountable as well.
So that means that every time you're out in the workplace and you hear someone make a rash oath, that you're almost bound to say, that was stupid, repent of that.
That was wicked.
That was wicked. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Because that way, if you don't do that, you're suffering sin on your neighbor, on your neighbor's
right.
head.
Right. You need to, well, you need to call it to their attention, or you need to say something, you know, remove yourself from that situation if it's not going to do any good or whatever. But you can't sit with that.
Does the same also go for just general blasphemy against God?
Yes. Okay. You know, when people are taking oaths or vows, and when they're invoking the name of God in a profane manner, you know, you bear some responsibility if you're willing to hear it without your soul being vexed.
Right. Is that what's happening with Lot in
yeah,
Sodom?
There's at least one thing that's happening with Lot. Right, we know that ignorance did not relieve one of culpability if we look at Leviticus 5:4.
Leviticus 5:4. Or if a soul swear, pronouncing with his lips to do evil or to do good, whatsoever it be that a man shall pronounce with an oath, and it be hid from him, when he knoweth of it, then he shall be guilty in one of these.
Yeah, so even if you're ignorant of it, but if you come to know of it, now you can be guilty. How much more then, if that's the case, the point is how much more when you're actually engaging this profane swearing. Right? You're going to be tainted by this just by entertaining the thought without challenge. And how much more then if you're the one doing it? All right, fifth. The prophet Zechariah specifically includes false oaths as matters which are hated by God. Zechariah 8:17.
Zechariah 8:17. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath, for all these are things that I hate, saith the Lord.
Yeah, God doesn't take time out very often to single out sins where he expressly says, I hate this particular sin. He hates sin. But some sins, he tells us very specifically he hates, and one of them is false oaths. Taking vows that are really taking his name in vain. You know, because you have, whether you know it or not, whether you acknowledge it or not, you've called him to be witness. You've roused him to do something. And if the matter is false, the something that you're rousing him to do is not going to be pleasant. It's not going to be good. You're calling down the wrath of God. God already has a judgment day set. There are plenty of punishments coming down the line for a lot of people. Do you really want to disturb him before Judgment Day to get an extra kick on your way to hell? Because that's essentially what you're doing when you blaspheme. Which is the same as this taking an oath. And if you don't think that that's what people are doing, you know, listen to, if you hear people taking God's name in vain, very often it is in a context where they are, in fact, demanding that you pay attention to something that they're saying because it's true and important. There actually is a confirmatory aspect very often to what it to when they do this. I'm not saying always, but very often. You know, most people don't just blaspheme, right? There's very often something else going along with it. They're saying something else, and they take the name of God in vain, or they blaspheme against His attributes. Right? And it's for some point of emphasis. It's punctuation of some kind. And that just confirms that this is what they're doing. It's an oath. And at some subconscious level, if not consciously, some subconscious level, they know that. All right, sixth, Christ himself, so far from teaching that all of us are unlawful, again, contrary to what we talked about a couple weeks ago, you know, the idea the Quakers have that, you know, no oaths or vows are ever lawful. Christ himself indicates that God is properly appealed to in swearing, but that it's better not to swear than to swear and not perform, which is very much in keeping with other passages in Scripture. So let's look at Matthew 5, 33 and 34, compared with Ecclesiastes 5, 4 through 6.
Matthew 5, verse 33. Again, 33 and 34. Again, ye have heard that that it hath been said by them of old time, thou shalt not forswear thyself, but shalt perform unto the Lord thine oaths. But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne.
Ecclesiastes 5, verses 4 through 6. When thou vowest a vow unto God, defer not to pay it, for he hath no pleasure in fools. Pay that which thou hast vowed. Better is it that thou shouldest not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Wherefore should God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands?
Yes, again, this goes to that point about this being a weighty matter. It's a solemn act. It shouldn't be entered into rashly. Shouldn't be undertaken on just any old occasion. But it really shouldn't be done when the matter of it is not true. Right? Or some portion of it is not true. Don't try to bundle the truth with a lie in a vow. Or an oath. It's going to get you in trouble with God. More trouble than just lying.
What about if you're called to vow and you only tell half the truth, where you might leave some things out? Is that still a violation of the vow? Because you're not saying something false, but if you leave out something that's true, in a way it could slander by leaving out certain information, or, you know, it could you can paint a false picture.
Yes, so if we're talking about a situation where you're called to give testimony regarding some factual thing and it's going to leave the wrong impression, certainly. you know, you're in violation of this. And you're not to give the wrong impression.
So in a way, not telling the whole truth.
But, I would say sometimes, you know, not telling something actually is going, in that kind of case, is actually going to leave someone with the right impression and not the wrong impression. You can throw something in about someone or some situation that would actually leave a lot of people with the wrong impression. Whereas if you left that piece of information out, it would leave what you are persuaded to be is the truth is actually closer to you know, the real fact. So, you know, you need to be careful here. You need to be very, very careful how you approach this. You know, what you say needs to be true. But sometimes if you say everything that's true, you can actually give the wrong impression about someone or something. You know, so it can go both ways. You need to think about what you're saying. You also have to consider the authority of the one who's tendered the oath and their right to know in different situations. You know, you don't. We're not trying to create a situation here where taking an oath or a vow becomes the equivalent of popish auricular confession, where, you know, everything. I mean, there. I don't know if people are still doing this, but there was a priest, Ligiri, who had a manual that was all, it was for confessors, how to take confession and how to examine people and get them to reveal everything that they've ever done at any time under any circumstance. That's not the point of an oath or a vow. You can destroy it. If you're under oath, for example, to tell the truth about something, by throwing something in there that you know, for example, would prejudice a jury against a defendant. You know, that's not necessarily, I mean, telling the truth. You know, if you have reason to believe that this person's innocent and you go ahead and throw something like that in, then you're not really giving sound testimony. Right? And you're not really fulfilling that oath. But again, when we're taking oaths and vows and there's a religious purpose, we're probably not going to be getting into those kinds of situations. We're going to be taking oaths or vows that respect God's commands, God's expectations for us, and so on. So we're going to be engaging at a macro level, not necessarily a micro level, where we're going to be trying to evaluate every piece of information possible. All right, the second question. May any man bind himself by oath to anything but what is good and just, and what he believes so to be, and what he's able and resolving to perform? Answer is no. We want to look at Genesis 24. Verses 2, 3, 5, 6, 8, and 9.
Genesis 24, verses 2 and 3. And Abraham said unto his eldest servant of his house that ruled over all that he had, Put, I pray thee, thy hand under my thigh, and I will make thee swear by the Lord, the God of heaven and the God of the earth, that thou shalt not take a wife unto my son of the daughters of Canaanites, among whom I dwell. And verses 5 and 6. And the servant said unto him, Peradventure, the woman will not be willing to follow me unto this land. Must I needs bring thy son again unto the land from whence thou camest? And Abraham said unto him, Beware thou that thou bring not my son thither again. And verses 8 and 9. And if the woman will not be willing to follow thee, then shalt thou be clear from this my oath. Only bring not my son thither again. And the servant put his hand under the thigh of Abraham his master, and swear to him concerning that matter.
Okay, so think about that. When Abraham has his servant swear that he's not going to allow his son to marry a woman from the Canaanites, he's going to go back and find someone, bring someone back from his own family, his own tribe. Right? He doesn't. He's not as progressive as people today. He wants somebody from his own tribe, and so he sends him back. But with this. The important thing is this caveat. Right? He's making him swear that he's going to do this. But he says, the servant very, very rightly says, what if, I'm willing to swear this, but what if the woman that I want to bring back says no? What if she says no? I'm willing to perform, in other words, what's in my within my ability to perform. I'm willing to go. I'm willing to seek this woman or these women. But what if we get to the point where she says no? She's not going to come. And Abraham very rightly says, well then, in that case, you're absolved from this oath. Right, you're not being asked to do anything that is not within your ability. You can't take an oath to do something outside of your ability. Right. Now, the other thing here is what? This servant very clearly evidences a resolve to do that which he is taking an oath to do. Okay, so he's very, very clear. He thinks this is good and just, right? I mean, we could even talk about this a little bit under the next thing that we're going to talk about. This is an oath being imposed by lawful authority. Abraham's his master. He's his boss man. He's the head guy. He's the head of the house. And so he has the authority, the lawful authority to impose this oath. But what's most important for our point here is both of them are cognizant of and careful to make sure that the matter of the oath is not only true and good, but also that it's within the ability of the one who's taking the oath to perform. And that he has the resolve fully to perform it. But the swearing of an oath is a devotional exercise. It's religious. Every act performed in holding intercourse with God is religious. And therefore, this too. Look at Deuteronomy 6:13 again.
Deuteronomy 6, verse 13, Thou shalt fear the Lord thy God and serve him, and shalt swear by his name.
Yeah, this is a holding of intercourse with God when you take an oath. Remember, when you take an oath or a vow, it's not just you or you and another person or you and other people, but God is being called to be witness. He's being invoked to be a party to this agreement.
Now, for example, when you take your baptismal vows,
yes,
is there within that, obviously, you have, what do you call it? You have the desire or the ability to perform it.
You have the ability to perform it.
But inherent in human nature is still the sinful nature. So you can still, there's still almost like, I don't want to say leeway, but there's still like almost like a grace period or a buffer where you can ask for more grace to keep your vows.
You can ask for more grace to keep your vows, but it's much more serious when you sin against baptismal vows than just sinning. You know, you're adding degrees and levels of aggravation and complicity. You are now become complicit in your own sin in a way that you perhaps were not before that. It's going to go worse on Judgment Day for people who were baptized, whether they were baptized as infants or as adults. If you fall on the wrong side of Judgment Day, it's going to go much worse for you than had you never been baptized or lived in a country where you could hear the gospel.
But for any kind of vow, it's okay to take it, but to know that you need more grace to perform it or right for any, I guess, for anything.
Well, any kind of oath or vow, you certainly want to be cognizant of the fact that you, and this is something that's going to come up, I believe, in one of the later sections. We're going to talk about this more. You must have, you're going to need grace to do what it is. No vow or oath is going to be performed in or through your own strength. Just because of the nature of man apart from Christ, and, you know, your fallen nature, indwelling sin, and so on. But that's not to let you off the hook, you know, with respect to where you are going to stand if you violate these oaths and vows.
So that shouldn't scare someone who may be deathly afraid that knowing their sinful nature, they can't keep this oath by themselves.
No, there is it within your power? By the grace of God, yes, it is. You know, is it within your power naturally? No. But that, as a believer in particular, that is not or should not be viewed as an impediment. Thus we see a man acting in a devotional frame towards God who is good and just. Look at Mark 10, 18, Jeremiah 50, verse 7.
Mark 10, verse 18. And Jesus said unto him, Why callest thou me good? There is none good but one, that is God.
Jeremiah 50, verse 7. All that found them have devoured them, and their enemies said, We offend not, because they have sinned against the Lord, the habitation of justice, even the Lord, the hope of their fathers.
Okay, if a man who's then acting in this devotional frame is good and just, must he not, in the very act of taking an oath, cleave to that which is good and just? Again, Zechariah 8:17.
Zechariah 8:17. And let none of you imagine evil in your hearts against his neighbor, and love no false oath, for all these are things that I hate, saith the Lord.
Yeah, and that this is, I think, something to consider, right? That in taking an oath or vow, the best disposition, the best time is really at a time or when you are in a disposition that we would refer to as devotional, when you are, in fact, engaged in the worship of God. This is really why, when, for example, when the covenants were taken in Scotland, there were acts of worship that were associated with that covenant taking. The same in the taking of the Solemn League. But this is also why, because of the nature of the sacrament of the Lord's Supper and the renewal of vows that are being undertaken in that. This is one reason why the Church of Scotland in particular was concerned to have a day of fasting before and a day of thanksgiving after, so that all of this is transpiring within the context of maintaining a devotional frame towards God. You're going to be in a much better position to enter into an oath or vow if your frame toward God is at its best, right? It's most spiritual. Okay, additionally, it's imperative that the oath taker, like those who make vows, bind himself to that which he's both able and resolved to perform. Deuteronomy 23:21-23 and Numbers 3:2.
Deuteronomy 23, verses 21-23. When thou shalt vow a vow unto the Lord thy God, thou shalt not slack to pay it, for the Lord thy God will surely require it of thee, and it would be sin in thee. But if thou shalt forbear to vow, it shall be no sin in thee. That which has gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a freewill offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth.
Numbers 30, verse 2. If a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word, he shall do according to all that proceedeth out of his mouth.
So again, you need to be clear. You're going to enter in an oath or vow. It has to be something that you are able to do, and that you resolve to do. You know, if you have the ability to do it, but you're just not going to do it, all you're going to be doing is calling down the wrath of God. Right? On the other hand, if you have the resolve to do it, but you don't have the ability, that's really just foolish overweening on your part to think that you're going to, you know, you're going to be able to do something just because you really are resolved to do this. I might really be resolved to jump off a cliff and fly by flapping my arms. But it's not going to happen. And if I take an oath to do so, it's going to be disastrous in two ways. Right? I'm going to die, and immediately I'm going to face judgment for taking that stupid vow or oath to do such a foolish thing. Right? It's not within my ability. So let's be clear. You know, we're not. We can take this a step further. It's not within the authority, and it is no part of lawful authority to impose an oath or a vow on people if they're not able to do it. Right? Now, being resolved to do it, well, that's a different thing. You know, if there's a lawful authority, as we're going to see in a minute, imposing something, you need to be resolved to do it. You need to direct your attention and your energy. So some things you just don't have, you don't have it in your power, as it were, not to have the resolve to do it. That brings us to the third point that we're going to discuss, and that is question 3. Is it a sin to refuse an oath touching anything that's good and just being imposed by lawful authority? The answer is yes. We will get Numbers 5, 19 and 21.
Numbers 5, verses 19 and 21. And the priest shall charge her by an oath, and say unto the woman, If no man hath lain with thee, and if thou hast not gone aside to uncleanness with another instead of thy husband, be thou free from this bitter water that causes the curse. Then the priest shall charge the woman with an oath of cursing, and the priest shall say unto the woman, The Lord make thee a curse and an oath among thy people, when the Lord doth make thy thigh to rot and thy belly to swell.
So, again, if the oath is about something good and just, then this is a case where the woman is accused or suspected of adultery by her husband, brought before the priest, and he charges her. She can't refuse this oath. It's within her ability, very clearly, to declare, again, very clearly, the state of affairs regarding the suspicion or charge. But, of course, she may not be resolved at first to do it. However, being brought before the priest, she needs now to be resolved to do it, right? Because it's sin to refuse this oath when it is being imposed by a lawful authority. You may not always like when these oaths are being imposed. But that doesn't give you an excuse. As long as you're able. And the purpose of an oath being the confirmation of the truth. Look at Hebrews 6:16.
Hebrews 6:16. For men verily swear by the greater, and an oath for confirmation is to them an end of all strife.
Yeah, no oath imposed by lawful authority ought to be refused. And after all, the point of this oath is to bring an end of controversy, to bring an end to whatever is being contested. It's to reach a resolution. It's to stop a conflict. You know, you can't... And those who are in lawful authority cannot resolve conflict if they don't have a right to get to the bottom of whatever is at issue, for example. Right? You need to be able to know the facts. And in order to know the facts, you have a right then, as a lawful authority, to impose on those who are able to bring those facts, or the various things that have bearing on the question at hand, to the table in a way that everyone can be assured is in truth. Does this mean that everyone is going to present the same picture? Actually, not. Right? Because one of the hallmarks of false witnesses, beside their testimony not agreeing together, is when it agrees too much. And it sounds like they've been in concert and they made a conspiracy against the truth. So it can be either way. You know, we've got those witnesses that came before Christ whose testimony didn't agree. We also have Ananias and Sapphira, who had worked out too many details and were clearly lying to Peter and to the Holy Ghost, right? Ultimately to the Holy Ghost. Okay, so lawful authorities then have the right to impose oaths when they're good and just. That is, when the end of that oath is for some good end or just end. They're seeking goodness or seeking justice in that. So we can say then that the Anabaptists and others who are maintaining that all oaths, even those imposed by lawful authority, are to be refused. This is certainly a problem. If you take the Anabaptist point of view, there is no end of controversy. You know, there is no mechanism for reaching a resolution. God has appointed oaths and vows, particularly oaths in this case, for that. Right? He wants an oath. And he wants the truth. And lawful authorities, because they are, as we'll see when we talk about the civil magistrate, for example, we talk about the church and at least get into the government a little bit, although we've talked about that more in the form of presbyterial government. Lawful authorities in church and state have a right and an obligation to seek what is good and true and just. And the only way they can do that is by having this ability to call people, to summon people. So the right of subpoena, for example, whether it's a church court or it's a civil court, is not inherently a wrong thing. And to refuse being you know, when you are subpoenaed to testify is problematic. Yes.
Are you bound to answer a subpoena from an unlawful government? Can you just say the United States court, you know, caused it, you know, because you're not paying tax or something? Could you just blow them off and say whatever? Go pound sand. You're not a lawful authority.
You have an obligation, even with an unlawful authority. You have a twofold obligation. One is you have an obligation when it is about something which is inherently lawful. All right? Because, you know, the law was made for the ungodly, the wicked and the sinner. But that doesn't mean that believers are to commit sin, right? So if there's some moral right, there's some good, or there's some justice involved, then you have that. The other thing is, at that point, yes, you can resist, but you are going to need to consider at what point it might be that your resistance is going to be futile. You do have, in the course of your interactions with an unlawful authority, you have the right at any time to pay the bribe rather than be deprived of something of greater value, whether it's property or life. All right. They're confuted for the following reasons. Number one, lawful authority is duty-bound to administer justice and do good. Romans 13:4.
Romans 13:4. For he is the minister of God to thee for good, but if thou do that which is evil, be afraid, for he beareth not the sword in vain, for he is the minister of God, a revenger to execute wrath upon him that doeth evil.
Yeah, a lawful authority, a just authority, a moral authority is actually duty-bound. By the very nature of that office and authority, they're duty-bound to administer justice and do good. And tendering of oaths is one means by which these ends are achieved. Look at Exodus 22:7-11.
Exodus 22:7-11. If a man shall deliver unto his neighbor money or stuff to keep, and it be stolen out of the man's house, if the thief be found, let him pay double. If the thief be not found, then the master of the house shall be brought unto the judges to see whether he have put his hand unto his neighbor's goods. For all manner of trespass, whether it be for ox, for ass, for sheep, for raiment, or for any manner of lost thing, which another challengeth to be his, the cause of both parties shall come before the judges, and whom the judges shall condemn, he shall pay double unto his neighbor. If a man deliver unto his neighbor an ass, or an ox, or a sheep, or a beast, or to keep, and it die, or be hurt, or driven away, no man seeing it, then shall an oath of the Lord be between them both, that he hath not put his hand unto his neighbor's goods, and the owner of it shall accept thereof, and he shall not make it good.
Yeah. Now, obviously, I would say this. Oaths are going to be much more effective from a practical point of view in a society where people believe that there is a cause and effect. That is, if I break this oath, God is going to smack me. Right? I'm asking God to judge me. That there's going to be some penalty meted out beyond the mere penalty of the state. But now, as the religious fiber of a society decreases, the state is going to have to enact greater and greater penalties for perjury to make up for the irreligious nature of a people, because irreligious people are ungovernable at a number of levels. So the oath or the vow has actually been not only in Christian societies, so remember, this is a light of nature issue at the bottom. Even though it's religious, it's still light of nature, and it's been something which has provided a bedrock of stability in administrations of government throughout the world. The second consideration why they're confuted is that in a reforming state, when Jerusalem was being rebuilt, the magistrate removed this godly imposition. Look at Nehemiah 5:12.
Nehemiah 5:12. Then said they, "We will restore them, and will require nothing of them. So will we do as thou sayest." Then I called the priests and took an oath of them that they should do according to this promise.
Right. So again, you know, if there are Anabaptists and people like them who reject or are skeptical about this doctrine of oaths and vows, you know, this is something which was practiced in a reforming state as well. This is not something that is was, for example, only under one time or place. We can find this going on at all times and all places, and it belongs particularly in situations because, you know, Anabaptists reject the idea of Christians being magistrates or the oaths and vows. The fact is, we have believers here who are engaging in oaths and vows. Now, we've got their entire problem of this radical dichotomy that they draw between the Old and New Testaments, but that's a little bit of a different issue. They're going to resist taking instruction from Nehemiah because of it, but again, that's a different issue. Religious people, in the Bible, oaths and vows pertain to people who are not only under the ceremonial law, but also those who just have the light of nature. It's both. It's also at times of declension, times of reform. Particularly religious people are very forward in this taking of oaths throughout the Old Testament. And Paul himself, as we've alluded to a number of times, is very clear that he doesn't resist this idea of taking oaths when he calls God to witness what he's saying is true. So if you have a lawful authority and they're imposing this vow, it's actually sinful for you to resist that. You don't really have a right to do so. You're not always the best judge of whether or not you should be taking an oath. Right? As long as the oath that's being tendered is lawful, tendered by lawful authority, it's good and just, and it's something within your ability. You know, if a lawful and otherwise lawful authority were to require an oath of you to do something that is entirely outside of your ability, well, you couldn't take it. You would have to resist that and tell them you just simply couldn't take it. Then it would be impossible for you to perform. But you need to make sure it is really impossible for you to perform. Very often, lawful authorities, generally, I would actually say, are not going to impose those kinds of oaths for something outside of your ability. It may be outside of your willingness or your resolve, but that's the point of this last sentence in section 3. You know, it's sin. In other words, you need to resolve to do it. So within your ability, you need to resolve to do it if they're imposing this oath or vow upon you. Right? And that really, in historical context, that's one way to say to covenant refusers, look, this is within your ability. You need to resolve to do it. It's lawful authority imposing it. You need to take this vow. You don't really have a right to refuse it. Okay, next time, what we want to look at in chapter 22, section 4, we're going to talk about the nature of the oaths, the words that are used, and the idea of mental reservation. We're not to use equivocating words. We're not to engage in mental reservations. And we'll also talk about whether or not making an oath or a vow with a heretic or an infidel, if that is inherently invalidated, or if we're required to keep an oath or vow with a heretic. And that's an important question in terms of the Westminster Assembly, because the Roman Church's view was that oaths and vows made to or taken from heretics or infidels were not to be kept. Protestants have a little bit different view on that, in fact, a very different view on that, and that'll be another part of what we're going to talk about next time when we take up the doctrine of oaths and vows.